From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It was 10 years ago this week that Hurricane Katrina made landfall on the Gulf Coast, ripped across three states, devastated New Orleans, a city inundated when levees gave way. Shocking destruction. More than 1,400 lives lost. Some said shut it down. It didn't shut down. It's come back in part and changed. This hour on Point, we're looking at the story of New Orleans 10 years after Hurricane Katrina. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Were you there? Are you there now? How would you describe what happened and what's happened since Katrina? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. 10 years ago, coming up August 29th, it was forming. This was the Weather Channel tracking the hurricane's path along the Gulf Coast. This was 5 a.m., August 29th, 2005. The hurricane's eye was about 90 miles from New Orleans, winds about 150 miles an hour.
Eventually, it will move over southeastern Louisiana back into the Gulf, and then a second landfall expected into Mississippi. So the worst of it is yet to come. You think it's bad now? It is going to get worse.
Worse than anyone imagined. Here was the next day. ABC News reporting the fate of New Orleans had changed overnight.
In New Orleans, we have a major American city underwater. New Orleans thought it had been spared the worst. And then two major levees broke, and slowly the city filled today with water. Canal Street is now a canal. The city is going to be essentially uninhabitable for many days.
And then day after day, week after week, scenes of rescue here from New Orleans news station WWL.
Oh, my gosh. Here we are. We're crossing into Orleans Parish, and it's unbelievable how many homes are just underwater, up to the windows some places, up to the roofs and others.
Four-fifths of the city underwater. 10 years later, here we are. Joining me now from New Orleans is Jarvis DeBerry, award-winning columnist for NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune. Jarvis DeBerry, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us again.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from New Orleans, Flozell Daniels is with us, president and CEO of the Foundation for Louisiana. Flozell, welcome to you. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Jarvis, how do you describe 10 years on, people who don't know New Orleans, who maybe weren't there then and haven't been there since, how do you say to them in a nutshell what's happened? We'll dig in, but top line, what's happened with the city?
It's hard to make it in a nutshell, Tom, because different people have different experiences. You can see parts of the city that seem to be thriving, as you said earlier, crackling with energy. And there are other parts that seem completely deserted and stagnant, if not completely dead. And much depends on who you were then and what you had then and what kind of insurance and employment and how firmly rooted you were in the American dream and stability. And much of it depended on that. And so if you were fairly stable financially and economically before the storm, you probably did all right. If you were living on the margins, then you're probably still on the margins now.
Flozell, talk about the population of New Orleans and how it's changed. I'm looking here, maybe 100,000 fewer African Americans in New Orleans now.
Yeah.
Thousands more white Americans. Who left? Who came?
Well, I think, to Jarvis's point, it's a different community in some ways. And what we saw, I think the recovery has been congruent with America's history of inequity and challenges across race and class. And so essentially people who could not come back were those who didn't have the resources, Tom. They did not have the networks and the opportunities. And unfortunately, for all of the great and good things that happened with America, both public and private dollars coming to our rescue, we still see significant challenges with people who want to be back home, but who either financially cannot afford to come back home or have other barriers. And I think that's a lot of what we're thinking about as should happen over the next 10 years. What would that look like?
Many billions poured into New Orleans and beyond. Black mayor then, of course, white mayor now, Mitch Landrieu, telling USA Today recently the city is back and strong. Here he is.
I think the big picture is that New Orleans is back. It's back in a big way. It's an amazing story of resurrection, of redemption, of resilience. The people of New Orleans that some people in this country wrote off would be surprised to know that the people of New Orleans, through what I would consider to be a traditional American spirit basically said, look, this is our home. This is where we live. This is where our history is. This is where our faith is. This is where our families are. We're going to rebuild this place.
Well, I think, you know, the mayor has a job, and a part of that is to really transmit positive messages. The truth is, there are some things that have come back really strong. The economy is resurgent. What's happening, I think, with nonprofit leadership, civic engagement has been really strong. People have shown up. Where there has been a great recovery, we like to say it's a people-powered recovery. But you've seen the numbers, Tom. We've worked closely with the data center down here and other sources. And the truth is we still have significant challenges making sure that everyone gets a chance to participate in the prosperity and the resurgence that's happening in the New Orleans economy and community.
And there has been an astonishing amount of rebuilding. Not everybody's in on that. They'll hear another New Orleans resident talking with USA Today, John Butte.
It hasn't been easy, man. You know, anybody who tell you that the last 10 years have been easy, they're not telling you the truth. You know, it's been very difficult. It's been extremely difficult for the young, the old, and the poor.
We will look at it all. Flozell, if you want to understand the bright side, the upside, and it's very substantial. If you visit New Orleans, you see it, you feel it. Talk to us about what's new, what's shiny, and you know, dazzling these days. It is there.
Well, I think it is there. I think news reports have seen, and we certainly have seen an upsurge in entrepreneurism, so-called social entrepreneurism, people really stepping up and trying to create new solutions to our older, more intransigent challenges. There is a great debate, Tom, happening about public education. And so we have $1.8 billion in new school buildings and really some debate about what the future of public education looks like. And so that's an interesting point. And something else that's really been important in the conversation as of late, but that has brewed up over the last 4 or 5 years, is a resurging housing market and what's happening because of it. So we're now starting to see strong signs of gentrification, and people are starting to have conversations and take actions on how we're going to protect the character of historic neighborhoods. One of the reasons people love New Orleans so much is because it has such unique and rich culture and history. We want to preserve that while seeking to expand opportunities for people who, Tom, have been on the margins for more than 150 years in New Orleans. And 10 years is just not enough time to get that work done. We're still working toward that goal.
10 years ago, struggling with survival. Now, you and others, Flozell Daniels, have pointed out New Orleans, in part, struggling with gentrification. That's a different thing. $71 billion in federal spending since then in Louisiana, most of it in Metro New Orleans. Jarvis DeBerry, how do you describe the upside of the development of these 10 years? Paint a picture for us for people who don't live where you live.
Well, there are places in the city that had very few businesses. You didn't see many pedestrians. You didn't see any real vibrancy. I'm thinking of Ferret Street uptown, or rather Castle Haley, which is in Central City. And you see places that a lot of new businesses have sprung up. You see pedestrians at all hours of the day walking. You see commerce in those places where you didn't see commerce before. Even on Broad Street and even parts of Canal Street, we've had a new hospital being built on Canal Street near downtown. And so there's a lot of construction. It was delayed. We thought it was going to come a lot sooner than it actually came. But you see that all over. Now, whether the people here are benefiting that as well as or as much as they think they should be benefiting from it is the question. You talk about housing prices. The housing prices around the neighborhood where I live, it's not quite uptown, but nearby, are just through the roof. And it is difficult to imagine people of modest means being able to move into New Orleans now and to find a house in a thriving neighborhood that they can afford. Now, you may be able to find a house in a mostly flooded neighborhood. You may be able to find a house in places that are kind of run down and look neglected. But if you want to be in a thriving community, and buy a house that's safe for your family and that you can go out and enjoy the things that so many other New Orleanians are doing, you're going to be looking at a very, very large bill.
But and if you cast your mind back 10 years, Jarvis, I mean, just the idea that we'd be saying housing prices are through the roof in New Orleans. There were people wondering if New Orleans would still exist. I remember those conversations, Jarvis.
Yeah, and there are people, Dennis Hastert most notably, who didn't know if the city should be rebuilt again. There have been a lot of people I've heard this week kind of grousing about the idea of celebration this weekend. I personally think that this is an appropriate time to celebrate the fact that we are still here and the fact that so many of us are yet alive. It is undeniable that we lost so many people and so many of our communities were torn apart. There are neighbors that we may never have seen again. There are institutions and businesses and some churches that have never reopened their doors. And yet, I think it is a moment that we need to sit and reflect that, wow, we are still here and we are still standing despite so many predictions that we wouldn't be here the next year, let alone 10 years later. And so I think that is important. Yeah, that people thought that we shouldn't even be rebuilt. And as you're saying now, the talk is of gentrification.
Jarvis DeBerry, please stand by in New Orleans at NOLA.com. Clozel Daniels at the Foundation for Louisiana. Dukes of Dixieland behind us here from the 2015 New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. Highest attendance this year since Hurricane Katrina. It's been 10 years. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about New Orleans, 10 years after Katrina, the hurricane, the flooding, the devastation, and where the city stands now. Jarvis DeBerry is with us from NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Clozel Daniels is with us from New Orleans, president, CEO at the Foundation for Louisiana. We'll hear from someone who's deep in the water business in this hour, and levees and protection and all the rest, and also from Brunel Cotlin. You may have heard him on StoryCorps last Friday. He has opened a grocery in the Lower Ninth, where that has been rare as can be. He'll join us from New Orleans. Cast your mind back. It was really scary, that crowded Superdome overflowing, houses and businesses underwater as far as the eye could see. Here, the U.S. Coast Guard, 10 years ago, airlifting New Orleans residents off their roofs to safety. This is the Coast Guard's radio broadcast.
Basket's coming up. Hold position. Basket is clear of the roof and hold position. Basket's coming up.
Okay, hold.
Basket is halfway up.
Now, 10 years later, here's Allison Plyer talking with Reuters. This is chief demographer at the data center in New Orleans about improvements, but not for everyone.
We see a lot of our economic indicators looking strong. Our average wages have gone up. We've had good jobs recovery through the recession. A lot of the folks who are benefiting from those positive trends are particularly the white community, whereas the African-American community, by and large, has not benefited in the same way and, in fact, feels that their life is more difficult.
Testimony on that front, New Orleans East resident Teresa Taylor here talking with New Orleans public radio station WWNO, saying her area of the city has not come back glossy as other parts of New Orleans.
We have an influx of Dollar Generals, of Family Dollars, and I'm like, are you trying to say, okay, this is the type of businesses that New Orleans East represents, and we don't represent all that.
Mac in New Orleans is calling. Mac, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks very much.
What do you see?
I think that if things have not improved for young black men here, then they haven't improved for anyone, really. I think that a lot of folks are moving to New Orleans and buying houses at a premium, which drives up the housing costs for everyone else. And then they tend to modify the architecture, turning double shotguns into single-family homes.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, lowers the sort of amount of housing that we have here. And the way that they change these houses, my grandfather was an architectural historian here, and it makes me crazy because I call it the beige washing. They'll paint houses just monochromatic colors, and they put up security cameras. They put the main entrance to the house on the side instead of the front. to sort of increase their personal sense of security. So I think people here are coming to consume our culture, but they're afraid also of the people who create that culture here.
Coming for the culture, afraid of the people who create it. Mac, I appreciate your call. It has been dramatic. I mean, and the change, racial change in some of these neighborhoods. Bywater, gone from majority black to majority white. One census block there went from 51% African-American before Katrina to 17% African-American afterward. There's a story there. Who's moving in? All kinds of people. Forbes, I'm looking at a report here, says put New Orleans in 2014 at the top nationwide in growth in the number of college graduates there. In 2013, number one in the country as destination where working-age Americans were moving in. Our caller Mac has some concerns about what that's doing to the city. One more from New Orleans. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I lived near one of the neighborhoods you talked about, the Ferret Street neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I lived there when the storm hit, and that was rough. That was a rough neighborhood. I mean, I would routinely hear gunfire at night. One time I heard a machine gun fire like 2 a.m, just 2 blocks away. That was a rough neighborhood. Mm. Now it's thriving. Same with the Bywater, same with Broad Street. You mentioned Broad Street.
Yep. Where
you could walk down there before Katrina. And it's still pretty rough now, but it's a lot better than it was. So I'm a little dismayed when people in town talk about gentrification as a problem, because so many of these neighborhoods were just horrible. And now people have come in, invested money, built the neighborhood up, built businesses. And I just think it's odd that we talk about gentrification as a problem. You know, gentrification means people with money are moving into the city, and that's a good thing.
Mike, we've got it, and I appreciate that perspective as well. Of course, some would look at it that way. We saw in 2014, a 43-year low in the murder rate in New Orleans. That has not been so great in 2015. There's been a spike this year. Flozell Daniels, you talk about gentrification as a problem. There's both sides of that opinion coming in from New Orleans right over the phone lines here. Mac, who says it's messing things up and beige washing the culture. Mike, who says, why complain about investment and newcomers who want to strengthen the city?
Right. You know, Tom, I think your callers have really are representing the way the discussion is being had. At the Foundation for Louisiana, our partners have actually been trying to have a different conversation, and that is where the nuance lies. In fact, neighborhoods that have people moving in, people buying and renovating homes, and creating or at least attracting commercial development, that's a good thing. All that people are saying is, I think as the first caller indicated, that where there are changes, we want to make sure that they are commensurate with the way we understand the character of these communities, the culture of this city and this region. And we want to make sure that people who are always there get a chance to participate in the resurgence. It's important for us. This is not just in New Orleans. This is across America. To understand that in every, quote, bad neighborhood, unquote, there are wonderful and good people. I grew up in the Ferret neighborhood. I remember the challenges that your last caller was discussing. But I also know there were wonderful, wonderful people who purchased their first homes in the Ferret neighborhood. They rented for 10 and 20 and 30 years. They raised their children, and they invested in that neighborhood. And I think the best way for us to move forward is for everyone to be able to participate in the prosperity that actually really helps us reduce crime and expands opportunity and improves quality of life for everyone.
Plenty of people who want to come down and appreciate that. Yes, Jarvis, please. Sorry.
I will also add to your last caller, I was on Broad Street all the time before Hurricane Katrina at Community Book Center. I was at Honoretha Castle Haley all the time at Ashi Cultural Arts Center. And to Flozell's point, you know, these places had a vibrancy before. It's just a different type of vibrancy now. And the question is, how inclusive can we be? You know, do we have to run people out of the city in order to improve it?
Part of that, of course, is education. New Orleans has famously flipped very dramatically and heavily to charter schools. Is that, Jarvis, raising up the generation that's going to come in and fill these jobs that are coming with all the investment?
I would hope so, but I can't count on it, and I can't make that guarantee right now. My biggest frustration with the schools and the stories about the school improvement in New Orleans is that I still do not see the type of public investment in them that you would expect if people believed them to really be as great as they are saying that they are. People all over the place are saying, oh, our schools are great, oh, our schools are great, oh, our schools are so much better, and yet they're still sending their children to private school.
Josh, and in New Orleans. Josh, Jarvis. Josh, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hey, how are you?
Okay.
My brother and I own a business here, and 10 years before, so before Katrina, pre-K, we had to entice people to come move here. It was hard to get people to move to take jobs. And now, afterwards, really, we have a flood of resumes, and we've got really talented people who want to join us. So I would say that, yes, we still have problems of inclusion, and I agree with that, and gentrification. But it's encouraging to me that New Orleans has different problems now. And that's a good story, a different set of problems.
Why do you think so many are ready and willing, even eager, to come to New Orleans now after we all saw that devastation, Josh? Why the new readiness?
Opportunity. I think people, some of it is altruism. Some of it is they want to come and make a difference. And some, it's awareness that there's opportunity and there's a momentum of jobs. So, and I think for young people, there's an excitement of trying to start something new. I think they can write their own story here.
Some came to help rebuild and just stayed. Pre-K, you call it, before Katrina. That's a new use of pre-K to my ear, anyway. Let's get a call from Atlanta, if I may. Steve is calling. Steve, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
A few years ago, 23, I visited a friend in New Orleans. And not long after that, I got up on the levee, and I looked at that huge, huge Mississippi River. And I
right by the city, degrees. Right there, and above much of the city, yes.
And I turned around, and I looked below me, and it dawned on me, New Orleans is 23 feet below sea level. Below sea level. That's even more than the Mississippi River. And I got the hell out of there the next day. There's no way I can understand why anybody in government lets people build in a floodplain. It's absolutely beyond me.
Let me respond to that, Tom.
Yes, there please, are parts Jarvis Berry. Thank you, Steve. Jarvis?
The city is not uniformly below sea level.
Of course.
That's a myth that has been broadcast and really been debunked.
But a bunch of it is.
Since Katrina. Mm-hmm. But parts of the city are below sea level, mm-hmm. yes. But I would point out that, you know, you have the Netherlands, which is almost an entire country that's below sea level, mm-hmm. and nobody's complaining about that.
The Dutch have known how to do it. If I may, let me bring Paul Kemp into our conversation from Baton Rouge. Paul is a coastal oceanographer, geologist. He's an adjunct professor at Louisiana State, and he is a commissioner for the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East. He was on the state forensics team that investigated the levee failure after Katrina. Paul Kemp, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. I'm glad to be there.
We've taken this show down to WWNO in New Orleans and been out on the water and seen the massive, massive new levees that have gone up. What is New Orleans' defensibility against another Katrina today, Paul, or even worse, the seas are rising, we're told?
Well, it's night and day from where we were. In the past, we really didn't know what kind of protection we have. Now we know the protection level, and we also know its limitations. So what our biggest worry going forward is complacency, because on our flood control standpoint, we have to be constantly working to improve the system. We can never stop, because the day we stop, the defenses are compromised.
If you had another Katrina this weekend, how would New Orleans fare?
We would, we would be hearing about it on the nightly news for a day or two. We would probably see some street flooding from rainfall, but we would not, we would have evacuated the city, which is a major undertaking. So there would be, it wouldn't be that it passed without notice. We would have evacuated the residents, but they would come back and find their neighborhoods intact and they would go about their business.
If New Orleans is safe, why would you need to evacuate? Evacuating a whole city is a pretty big deal, or much of it. If it's safe, why would that be necessary?
When I say safe is a relative term. The role of the levees is really to protect the infrastructure behind them, and we understand that with a very large storm, we're not going to be able to keep all the water out, and so the protection for people is mainly evacuation.
I mean, one of the lessons here that I've seen you refer to, Paul, is that the defenses in New Orleans are to defend the property there, but there's going to be water and danger to life, so get out if another Katrina comes, is I guess.
Absolutely, absolutely. You don't want to be there during a serious storm, and we do have a team that will operate the defenses and the pumps and so on, and make sure that the property is protected.
So what about our caller from Atlanta, Steve, who says this doesn't make sense? New Orleans will celebrate its 300th anniversary, old American city, in 2018. Is New Orleans going to be around as we get higher sea levels with climate change? Is it long-term defensible, Paul?
Well, New Orleans is like all port cities. It's there because it needs to be there. And the question is, you know, we'll be working against some of the trends that are felt all around the world in terms of climate change and sea level rise. The original defenses of New Orleans were actually vegetation, the marsh and the swamps around the city provided protection against surge and waves. It's very important from this point on what happens outside those levees in terms of the restoration of the coastal wetlands.
That's a big challenge to do that as seas rise and they continue to bite into them.
Yeah, we do have a big river to work with, though, which is an advantage in this case.
So bottom line for you, but people, be ready to move if another storm comes. My own sister was down there as the storm came in from Illinois and got out when you turned all the traffic around on the interstates and both sides were headed out, headed north.
Yes, but
if it comes again, out.
Absolutely. The annoyance that comes from having to leave and the interruption, that's something we have to live with.
Isn't it more than annoyance? I mean, cleaning up after that kind of flood took years.
Okay, well, I'm not talking about a flood where we have breaches in the levee system.
Okay.
Our system is built to survive even if it's overtopped. And that's a big difference from where we were 10 years ago. Now that the readiness of that system is only as good as our vigilance and the willingness of the people of New Orleans to continue to fund the maintenance and the upkeep and the improvement of that system. You know, we have some questions about that going forward.
Paul Kemp at the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East, joining us from Baton Rouge. Thank you very much, Mr. Kemp.
Okay, thank you.
Flozo Daniels, I want to come back to you on that front, the waterfront, Jarvis DeBerry as well. Sweet By and By here, New Orleans Jazz Funeral by the song by the Magnificent Sevens, played here in 2008. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we are talking today, just a couple of days before the big anniversary of landfall and then flooding, about New Orleans 10 years after Katrina. The broken levees, the devastation, the suffering, we all saw it, and a lot of rebuilding there. Not everybody is fully, or some not at all, in on that, but a lot has gone on. Lots of people have moved to New Orleans. Lots of others have moved out. 100,000 fewer African-American residents in 2013 than in 2000. Flozell Daniels is with us, President, CEO of the Foundation for Louisiana, joins us from New Orleans. Jarvis DeBerry is here from NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune there. You can join us in just a minute. We'll hear from Burnell Cotlin, who's opened a grocery in the Lower Ninth. You may have heard him on StoryCorps last Friday. But a couple of callers more here. So many lined up. Catherine in, not New Orleans, but far from home, maybe, in Greenwich, Connecticut. Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I belong to a Creole association, and we had our annual meeting 2 weeks before Katrina in August of 2005. I came back to Connecticut, and it was devastating for our members, and what got us through were the emails that we were able to connect with one another. We are going to be putting together a 10-year commemorative of the emails that sustained us. Our members, some of our members suffered terribly. I mean, I can't even begin to tell you.
And what's happened with that Creole population? Strong in New Orleans now, or dispersed,
yes,
or both?
Yes, yes. And we will be having our annual conference this year in October. Our theme this year is Music Transcends, Our Syncopated Journey from Reconstruction to Katrina. And we will be putting together commemorative emails. And many of our members evacuated to Atlanta, Houston, but they're coming back, and if anything, Katrina has made us stronger, and we are more determined than ever to preserve our Creole culture, our Creole history, and tell our story. And Katrina, be damned, we're not giving up.
Catherine raises the flag there for New Orleans Creole population, dispersed, but coming back, you say, Catherine. I appreciate your call. One from New Orleans here. Thank you, Catherine. Phyllis, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm the founder and executive director of an organization called Good Work Network that helps minority businesses participate in the economy.
Okay.
And I think a key part of this discussion is, first of all, you can't talk about New Orleans as an abstract place. It's a deeply rooted culture that those of us who are from here love.
Yep.
And can't part with. But it's also a culture that's at risk. It comes from...
Because of the influx of outsiders, or because of the gentrification, or why, Phyllis, the culture at risk?
Because of the lack of economic opportunity for the bearers of that culture.
Hmm.
So most of that culture comes from the people of color, and yet they have not benefited economically from that culture that is so much a part of the city. And, you know, so it's going to take an intentional, and this may be a poor metaphor, no, but the rising tide doesn't lift all boats, because there are a lot of people who don't have boats.
Yeah.
And it's really dangerous for them. It's why so many people weren't able to come back. And it's why we will lose our culture and we will lose our identity if we can't create economic opportunity for people of color and low-income folks.
Phyllis, let us pick that up, if we may. I appreciate your call, and forgive me, but there's just so many lined up here. Hoodoo Nola writes to us online, on our website, onpointradio.org. If you're listening via podcast or however, check out the conversation there. It is always vibrant. Hoodoo writes, many new businesses are not hiring pre-K, as in pre-Katrina, locals. But the newly arrived, they're not hiring pre-K neighborhood folks who very much need jobs they can walk to. That speaks to a whole lot of things. Flozell Daniels, you're listening there. As Phyllis says, the culture is at risk because the long-time residents of New Orleans can't find economic nurturing there.
Yeah, I think Phyllis has hit the nail on the head. We've been talking a lot about something that we call the cultural economy. And really, it's just a very a way of capturing the snippet. We're talking about this culture that people come to New Orleans for: the dance, the music, the food, the architecture. All of these are things that, in many ways, are primarily derived from she said people of color, but plainly speaking, black folk in the city. Historically, you call it from the Creole Association. And I think about the craftsmen and the lathers and those responsible for the beautiful creative architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've seen, Tom, is a situation where people are coming in, the economy is booming, the tourism economy is expanding, billions of dollars, and the people who bear or own the culture are hardly participating in those economies at all. So there's a lot of discussion, and I think it's a very affirmative discussion, about going forward, how is it that we make sure that people who own the culture get to participate in the economies that the culture supports? And by virtue of that, by virtue of them and their families being economically strong, then they get to preserve the culture in a way that they decide, and that continues to keep the character and culture of this community and continues to make us a global destination. And it improves and lifts up the lives of people who have always been from this community while continuing to welcome people to this community. I think it's really important to know that New Orleans is arguably the most welcoming city in the country.
A destination, but also a home that works for those there, I hear you saying, Flozell.
And what we're hearing from even our new residents, not all of them, we have some challenges with some people who want to change the culture. But many people who are moving here are also joining the fight. They want to be involved in preserving culture and community. And I think to Jarvis's earlier point, this is the time for us to lift these issues up and not just tell ourselves, but tell America. We think that the work of the next generation is going to be around expanding opportunity for all people as we continue the recovery.
David in New Orleans. Thank you for calling, David. What do you know there?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to make a comment that I was a co-founder of one of the charter schools in town. I'm actually in international business, so not an educator, but I was asked to be on the board and
okay.
co-founded one of the charter schools.
And charter schools really took over the public education system in New Orleans after Katrina, I guess, David.
They did. We have one of the highest, if not the highest, per capita rate of charter schools in the entire country. I think Chicago is second, maybe D.C.'s third, so we're at the top. But one of the issues that's really come up, I think we have about 40 now. In New Orleans,
wow.
And many of them have specialty focuses. Like mine is international business, international affairs.
Okay.
There's some others that focus on construction, biomed. But one of the issues in trying to diversify the education base and really broaden the whole economic and education middle class in the city has been a challenge of trying to get the natives. I'm a native New Orleanian, but trying to get the natives to change their mindset. We have a lot of people who come into town, but one of the issues that's come in is two charter schools, Ben Franklin and Lusher. And many of the white community, I'm white myself, many of the white community, if they can't get their kids into one of those two charter schools, they go private. And I have many people continue to tell me, oh, that's so great that you have a school, that we needed a better education for the black students. And they still see the public school system as a segregated system, with the exception of the two charters.
So the mindset that you would like to see change, David, is what exactly? Is it, you want people ready to study together across racial lines, or is it something else?
Of course. I mean, I think you need diversity. You need to have African Americans. You need to have white. You need to have Hispanic. We have a growing Asian community in the city. Everybody, those kind of lines shouldn't even exist. And without that, you create a divided culture. And what happens is when people go to get jobs and they want to go to the banks and they want to go to the law firms and they want to get those jobs and they want to get internships, they don't have access because they've been in a segregated system. And therefore, many of the very bright people from other communities in the city who aren't from the sliver by the river, as it's called, leave town because they have to go outside. And many of them become very successful outside the city because they can't prosper in what's been a 100-year problem.
The sliver by the river, that higher ground, which has historically not been as diverse. David, I really appreciate your call. Jarvis DeBerry, what about the trend lines in New Orleans in this decade, integration, segregation? What do you see?
Well, David is echoing the point that I made earlier, that it rings a little hollow when people are talking about how greatly improved the schools are and they're not sending their children to those schools. So it suggests they don't believe that they're improved enough. So I will believe that people believe that the schools are so much better when they're actually sending their children there. But there are a few standouts. I'm thinking of Morris Jeff Community School, for example, is one of those schools that has really an integrated student body. But you don't see that very often across the city of New Orleans now, and you definitely did not see it before the storm.
I want to bring in Burnell Cotlin. You may have heard him on StoryCorps last Friday talking with his mother about a grocery that he's opened in the Lower Ninth Ward, an area with very little retail activity going on, hit very hard by Katrina. Mr. Cotlin has opened the first grocery store in Lower Ninth to open up there in nearly a decade. Here he was on StoryCorps talking with his mother, Lily.
You saw something that I didn't see. I'm glad you took the chance.
Just seeing so many people and the look on their faces is a joy. It was a headache back then, but now it's all worth it. It was all worth it.
Burnell Cotlin has brought a grocery store to the Lower Ninth. And Mr. Cotlin, thank you very much for being with us today. Many people heard you tell that story with your mom last Friday, and it sounds like an optimistic story. We hear your commitment to it, but it took a long time to get a grocery back in your neighborhood, Burnell.
First of all, Tom, I want to tell you thank you for having me on your show. It's an honor. And to answer your question, yes, it has 10 years, a whole decade. And this is the only store north side of Claiborne in the Lower Ninth Ward.
What does that say to you about where the emphasis of redevelopment has been? Has your neighborhood felt abandoned? Why has it taken so long just to get a grocery? As you say, it shouldn't take 3 city bus rides to buy groceries, but it has.
Yeah, unfortunately it has. By me having the only business in this part of town, customers come in, some are happy, some are angry, everybody vent. I heard it all. I heard conspiracy. I heard gentrification. I hear everything. It's on a daily basis because there's nowhere else for them to go and to talk because it's the heartbeat of the Lower Ninth Ward. It's on Caffin and Galvis.
Why do you think it's taken so long? Have the banks not been willing to loan? Has there not been the capital there? Why?
Well, I had an opportunity, Tom, to talk to quite a few people. The large box stores say they're not coming back to the Lower Ninth Ward because there are not enough people. The people that want to come back home to Lower Ninth Ward say they're not coming back because there's no stores. But meanwhile, the people that are here in the Lower Ninth Ward, they're suffering. I know people, before I opened up this store, they used to have to catch 3 buses just to go and get a loaf of bread from Walmart. I know some people that had to save up money to get a cab. That's an undue hardship. So even though the big box stores or local government or whatever didn't want to come back, someone had to do something. And that somebody turned out to be me. I have no regrets. I would do this all over again. I had to spend my entire life savings in this building. But the look on a customer's faces that walk through this door, Tom, is phenomenal. I've had people to come in my store and cry. Some people high five. My total strangers don't even know, see me on the street. Here's a grocery store guy, and they'll hug me.
No, so listen, I think everybody's celebrating your story. With that StoryCorps telling was very moving. But if I ask you, Burnell Cotlin, how's New Orleans doing a decade after Katrina? What's your reply?
Yes, sir.
What's your reply?
New Orleans as a whole is not recovered as a whole. And the reason why I say that, because the Lower Ninth Ward is a part of New Orleans. Even though we're surrounded by 3 bodies of water, mm-hmm. the Mississippi River, the Industrial Canal, and the Florida Canal, we're still part of New Orleans. So it's still not developed. Now, again, I'm not, that's above my pay grade, the reason why the money didn't get to the Lower Ninth Ward, but it is what it is. We still have to go forward. And if no one wants to invest in the Lower Ninth Ward, invest in me. And I'm going to continue to make my community look like the rest of the city. I'm just an average guy with above average dreams. And my dream is to make the Lower Ninth Ward catch up with the rest of the city.
Burnell Cotlin, I am sure the whole country is wishing you luck. The Lower Ninth Ward market is open for business, and we're glad that you're doing it. Thanks for taking a minute to be with us right here.
I want to tell you, thank you for even talking about this here on your show. It's an honor. And for those that don't know, please come down to Caffin and Galvis. I have a GoFundMe account out there because I'm trying to open up the first laundry room back here. The reason why I want to open that up, Tom, they had a guy that came into my store last week. He had 2 big, huge garbage bags. He came in my store, bought a cold drink and some laundry detergent, walked to the bus stop, and he was going trying to find a laundry room.
Wow.
I want to open up a laundry room back here. I'm going to continue to fight to get my community to catch up with the rest of the city.
Burnell, good luck to you. Thank you so much, Burnell Cotlin, for joining us. Flozell Daniels, there's the people power you were talking about. One more call. Angela in New Orleans. Angela, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I'll try to be quick here. I've been in New Orleans for 25 years since I was a teenager. Love it. And I in no way want to insult Mr. DeBerry and other people. When I bring up the point that we need to remember that Hurricane Katrina did not hit New Orleans, it hit Mississippi. And even though I love here and I in no way have survivor's guilt, love my city, we still don't know what it's like for a hurricane to hit New Orleans. And that's why I bring up my point. And also just to point out to you, Tom, when you were talking to Mr. Kim earlier, the oceanographer, you were asking, you know, why would we have to evacuate? Remember, it's not just about the flooding. I have every confidence in our levee system, and I hope it doesn't let us down. Mm-hmm. I hope it's never put to the test, really. But just remember, when a hurricane does come to an area, I'm a Gulf Coast native, it's debris and wind-driven rain and other things that would make you evacuate a big city, not the fact that it might or might not flood.
Angela, I appreciate your call. Our time is so short. Yes, Mississippi got hit hard. I was down there with kids helping many others rebuild Bay St. Louis and beyond. Jarvis, are you confident? What if it had been a direct hit? What if it is down there? Paul Kemp says, the defenses are stronger against the water now. Long term, how do you see it, Jarvis?
Well, hurricanes are inevitable. Storms are inevitable. We know that another one is going to come sometime. What my hope is that the system, as it were, doesn't fall apart the next time. And I think that even if the water comes over the levees, that's something we'll have to accept. Just don't have them fall apart and wash houses away. And that would be a better situation than what we had in 2005.
A far better thing, no question. We're very grateful to the two of you for being our through line here today as we look at New Orleans 10 years after Katrina. Jarvis DeBerry at NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune. Thank you, as always, for being with us, Jarvis. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
And Flozell Daniels, President, CEO at the Foundation for Louisiana. Appreciate all your good work there. Keep it up. Thank you, Mr. Daniels.
Thank you for having us, Tom.
Listeners, especially in New Orleans, thank you for all your input today. The whole country is interested in you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.